Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and we're very excited tonight to have author Chad Culchin here with his new book, Men, Women, and Children. As most of you here know, Chad's previous novels, The Average American Male and The Lie, have a huge fan following. And now, with Men, Women, and Children, his writing has spread to an even wider audience and is receiving stellar reviews. Chad is a graduate from the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. Will you please join me in welcoming Chad Culchin?
Thanks, everyone, for coming out, including my sister in the front row with the little video camera. So I was going to read like a chapter out of my book, but before that, I was going to read some stuff out of this book right here called Heaven is for Real by Pastor Todd Burpo. I don't know if you're familiar with it. New York Times number one bestseller for many months in a row. It's about Todd Burpo's little kid, Colton, who's pictured here on the front with a terrible haircut, and it's about his journey after he was on an operating room table. He died for a couple of minutes or passed out for a couple of minutes and claims that he went to heaven. When he came back, he told his father and his mother all about what he saw there, and so his father, Todd Burpo, pastor, wrote this book, sold a million copies, and it's the most disgusting thing that has happened, I think, in the last year. So I'm going to read a few little pieces of this pile of shit for you now. Usually when I start writing in the morning, I'll watch The View, and that'll fire me up with a healthy dose of rage, but now I've taken to reading pieces of this book instead. So here we go. This is in the prologue, just one sentence that I'll read to you. It says, "Now, as a pastor, I'm not a believer in superstition." That's all. That one line to me is insane and let me know that I was going to really like reading this book for the rage purposes. This next little piece of it, for those just joining us, I'm reading from Heaven is for Real by Pastor Todd Burpo about his little kid going to heaven. It's, I hope that's a joke because I hate this book, but, so this next part is, when his little son Colton first kind of tells Pastor Todd Burpo and his wife named Sonia that what he's seen in heaven and that he's actually been there. And this is the first time that, Pastor Burpo kind of starts thinking maybe there's something to this. Colton turned his eyes up and to the right, the attitude of remembering. "Well, they sang Jesus Loves Me, and Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho," he said earnestly. "I asked them to sing We Will Rock You, but they wouldn't sing that." He's talking about the angels here. As Cassie giggled softly, Cassie is Colton's sister. As Cassie giggled softly, I noticed that Colton's answer had been quick and matter-of-fact, without a hint of hesitation. Sonia and I exchanged glances again. What's going on? Did he have a dream in the hospital? And one more unspoken question. What do we say now? A natural question popped into my head. Colton, what did the angels look like? That natural question that you might have after your son said something like that. He chuckled at what seemed to be a memory. Well, one of them looked like Grandpa Dennis, but it wasn't him, because Grandpa Dennis has glasses. Then he grew serious. Dad, Jesus had the angels sing to me because I was so scared. They made me feel better. Jesus? I glanced at Sonia again and saw her mouth had dropped open. I turned back to Colton. You mean Jesus was there? My little boy nodded as though reporting nothing more remarkable than seeing a ladybug in the front yard. Yeah, Jesus was there. Well, where was Jesus? Colton looked me right in the eye. I was sitting in Jesus' lap. If there's stop buttons on conversations, that was one of them right there. Astonished into speechlessness, Sonia and I looked at each other and passed another silent telegram. Okay, we really need to talk about this. Then we all piled out of the expedition and trooped into Arby's. I don't know if I mentioned New York Times number one New York Times bestseller. So that's where it kind of kicks off. I'm going to skip around now to some of my favorite parts. This is where Pastor Todd Burpo describes what he was feeling when his son died or went to heaven or whatever the case may be. Repulsive. Here we go. But none of that stuff hurt like watching what Colton was going through, and I got really mad at God. I continued, I'm a guy. Guys do something. And all I felt like I could do was yell at God. I described briefly my attitude in that little room in the hospital, blasting God, blaming him for Colton's condition, whining about how he'd chosen to treat one of his pastors as though I should somehow be exempt from troubles because I was doing his work. At the time, when I was so upset and so outraged, can you believe that God chose to answer that prayer? I said. Can you believe that I could pray a prayer like that and God would still answer it yes? What had I learned? I was reminded yet again that I could be real with God, I told my fellow pastors. I learned that I didn't have to offer some kind of churchy, holy-sounding prayer in order to be heard in heaven. You might as well tell God what you think, I said. He already knows it anyway, which is redundant. Most importantly of all, I learned that I am heard. We all are. I'd been a Christian since childhood and a pastor for half my life, so I believed that before, but now I knew it. How? As the nurses wheeled my son away screaming, Daddy, Daddy, don't let them take me. When I was angry at God because I couldn't go to my son, hold him, and comfort him, God's son was holding my son in his lap. That, to me, is it's among the most disgusting passages in this book. His claim that God, you know, he was astounded that God would listen to his prayer because he was so angry and stuff, completely ignoring the fact that millions upon millions of people live in misery day to day from this God that he claims answered his prayer. Repulsive to me, but I'll go on. There are many more repulsive passages. This one is really disturbing. Some backstory. So Todd Burpo, Pastor Todd Burpo, and his wife Sonia became pregnant prior to Colton. She miscarried the child. This passage deals with that because Colton saw the miscarried child in heaven on his journeys. We'd wanted to believe that our unborn child had gone to heaven, even though the Bible is largely silent on this point. We'd accepted it on faith, but now we had an eyewitness. A daughter we had never met was waiting eagerly for us in eternity. From then on, Sony and I began to joke about who would get to heaven first. There were several reasons she had always wanted to outlive me. For one thing, a pastor's wife has to put up with being used as a sermon illustration a lot. If I died first, she always told me, she'd finally get to tell the congregation all her stories about me. But now, Sonia had a reason for wanting to reach heaven first. When she was pregnant with the child we lost, we'd picked out a boy's name, Colton. But we never could agree on a name for a little girl. I liked Kelsey, she liked Caitlin, and neither of us would budge. But now that we know our little girl doesn't have a name yet, we constantly tell each other, I'm going to beat you to heaven and name her first. I don't know how many ways to describe how psychologically insane that is. On many levels. One, the God that he claims to love so much would be such a bastard that he would not name a miscarried child who shows up in heaven. He would just leave this vagabond child out in the streets to fend for itself and not even give it a name. Two, they're making bets apparently on who's going to die first so they can name this child. It's repulsive, disgusting, and I'll continue to some other chapters here. This is where Pastor Todd Burpo uses a 50-50 choice that his child makes and a question that he asks him to say that there's definitive proof the kid was in heaven. So this is the kid talking to Todd Burpo. And do you know that Jesus sits right next to God? Colton went on excitedly. Jesus' chair is right next to his dad's. That blew me away. There's no way a four-year-old knows that. It was another one of those moments when I thought, he had to have seen this. I was pretty sure he never even heard of the book of Hebrews, but there was one way to find out. Colton, which side of God's throne was Jesus sitting on? I asked. Colton climbed up on the bed and faced me on his knees. Well, pretend like you're in God's throne. Jesus sat right there, he said, pointing to my right side. The Hebrews passage flashed into my mind. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Wow, here was a rare case where I had tested Colton's memories against what the Bible says, and he passed without batting an eye. But now I had another question, one I didn't know the answer to, at least not an answer from the Bible. Well, who sits on the other side of God's throne, I said. Oh, that's easy, Dad. That's where the angel Gabriel is. He's really nice. That's kind of crazy. But so he asked this kid a 50-50 question, a coin flip. The kid answered it correctly. Clearly proof of heaven. Clearly. And the final thing I will read from this abomination is when he mentions the Dark Prince, Lucifer. We asked Colton about Satan a couple of times after that, but then we gave up, because whenever we did, his reaction was a little disconcerting. It was as if he changed instantly from a sunny little kid to someone who ran to a safe room, bolted the door, locked the windows, and pulled down the blinds. It became clear that in addition to the rainbows, horses, and golden streets, he had seen something unpleasant, and he didn't want to talk about it. Generally, I would assume that's probably what happens when you ask a four-year-old child about Satan, but I don't know. I'm no pastor. I'm no Todd Burpo. Number one bestseller of the New York Times. So that's that. I'm going to read some from my own book now. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm just going to read this first chapter, which is kind of like a... I don't know if any of you have read this or not, but it's kind of like a thesis for the whole book about what's happening to little kids, the internet, parents, sex, masturbation, etc. Okay, so here it is. Chapter 1. Don Truby thought about Kelly Ripa's anus. He thought about what it would look like as he slid his penis into it. This image was all he could focus on in the 45 minutes he had left of his dwindling lunch break. He took the largest bites he could from a Big Mac as he drove home, averaging 10 miles over the speed limit. He felt both anxiety and shame about the frantic level of effort he was willing to exert in order to create a 15 or 20-minute window in which he could masturbate. He allayed these concerns by reminding himself what his doctor told him a few weeks earlier during his annual physical, that for every year a man lives past 50, his chance of having some kind of prostate trouble, cancerous or otherwise, increased by 5%. And to combat these odds, his doctor added, it was wise to maintain as healthy a prostate as could be managed, which meant employing it in the creation of ejaculate as often as possible. Don was only 37, but he rationalized that regular masturbation could be considered a form of preventative medicine. This rationalization sustained him through the rest of his drive home. With roughly 35 minutes left in his lunch break, Don entered his house. By then, his mode of excuse had moved from medical prevention to blaming his wife for her lack of willingness to engage in sexual activity with him. They'd been married since they were in their early 20s, and they had a 13-year-old son, Chris. Both of these facts were things that he understood could take a toll on the libido of any average person, man or woman. Nonetheless, he couldn't help feeling that in the past year something had changed. The frequency of their sexual encounters had dwindled to once every month and a half, and his wife, Rachel, seemed completely uninterested in and unwilling to offer him fellatio or manual release as alternatives to intercourse when she wasn't in the mood, which had become excessively frequent. Don felt that he had no choice but to engage in the only sexual outlet on which he could still rely, semi-regular masturbation. He entered the bedroom that he and his wife shared, sat down at their computer, and tried to suppress the feeling of self-pity that always seemed to creep up on him at exactly this moment. He reminded himself that because of the schedules of everyone else in the house, these 20 to 30 minutes were the only ones he would have to himself all day, and hence the only ones he could use to satiate his biological need to ejaculate. The computer, which had been idle on the Windows loading screen for several seconds too long by Don's estimation, reverted to its boot-up screen. Don had seen this before with their previous computer. He knew it meant one of two things. Either the computer was just getting old and overused and it was time for it to be replaced, or more likely, he had browsed one too many pornography websites and accidentally infected it with some kind of virus or adware, spyware, that had rendered it inoperative. He decided to power the computer off, give it one more chance to make it out of the load screen into some form of operational status. But when he turned the machine back on, the same thing happened again. He wasn't looking forward to taking the computer to the Best Buy Geek Squad as he had done once before. But that was the least of his concerns. With 20 minutes left in his lunch break and no hard copies of pornography anywhere in the house as a result of Rachel having accidentally found his collection some years ago, at which point she forced him to destroy it in front of her, Don gave a brief thought to masturbating using only his imagination. He hated masturbating without pornography, always finding the orgasm to be less satisfying. But in order to get to the limitless fountain of pornography on the internet to which he had become so accustomed, he would have to resort to something he had never done. What he was contemplating would far surpass any level of indignity he might have felt for masturbating during his lunch break, or at work, as he had done twice before, or in his car outside his own home, or in virtually any other scenario in which he might have found himself in the service of ejaculating. He opened the door to his son Chris's room, purging all thoughts of guilt or shame. He knew he would have no time for either of those if he was going to make it back to work before his lunch break was over. He had purchased Chris a laptop the previous Christmas, primarily for schoolwork and video editing. Chris had expressed interest in possibly pursuing a career in television or film post-production. So when he asked for a video camera and a computer to edit on, Don and Rachel agreed to foster his curiosity. Don thought about these things for a fleeting moment before he opened the laptop and powered it up. The procedure Don used to reset the internet browser history on the computer in his and Rachel's bedroom had become second nature to him. It was not complex. He simply reset the entire history after each use of the computer for masturbatory purposes. Don knew that Rachel wasn't savvy enough to understand why the browser history had been cleared. Very infrequently, he would have to field one of her questions about the mysterious disappearance of a website she saw on Oprah from that little drop-down thingy. But a nonchalant, I don't know, or a sometimes the whole thing just resets so it doesn't get viruses, always seemed to satisfy her questioning. He was well aware that this would not be the case with Chris, who knew far more about computers and the internet than Don himself did. Before he logged on to bangbus.com, the website he had gotten a separate and secret credit card specifically to pay for 6 months prior, he planned to look through the browser history of his son's computer and write down each website. He then planned to erase the browser history after using his son's computer for the 5 to 10 minutes he assumed it would take him to reach the point of ejaculation. And finally, Don Truby planned to type back in all the websites that were originally in his son's browser history in the order in which he had written them down. He knew of no technique that would have been more efficient, although there were several. His son's browser history contained multiple social networking sites, a few music sites, some movie news websites, the Goodrich Junior High School website, and a few others that Don wrote down without giving them much thought. One site, however, was unfamiliar to him and gave no indication of its nature through its name alone, keysmovies.com. With only a few minutes left to masturbate, Don's curiosity overrode his carnal urges for the brief second that found him navigating to keysmovies.com instead of just writing it down and opening a browser window to bangbus.com. What he saw filled his mind with thoughts and reactions that were difficult to reconcile. Keysmovies.com, Don learned, was a website that contained page after page of thumbnail images that represented streaming videos one could access by merely clicking on the thumbnail. The videos ranged in length from a few minutes to well over 30 minutes, and they were all pornographic. The website was free and seemed to offer a much wider variety of pornographic content than bangbus.com. Don was immediately reminded of the time he found his father's secret stash of pornography. He was roughly the same age his own son was currently, 13. He'd been in the garage on an innocent errand, recovering a wrench from his father's toolbox in order to tighten the chain on his bicycle. After several minutes of looking for the wrench in various places that seemed likely, Don found a cardboard box labeled Junk from Old House and opened it. Inside, he found a dozen or so Penthouse and Playboy magazines, as well as a Super 8 film reel. The film reel was the obsession of his adolescent existence. He had no idea if his parents even owned a Super 8 projector, and beyond that, he would have no idea how to operate such a device, even if they did. He would, from time to time, when he became tired of using the same images in the dozen or so magazines, hold the film strip up to the garage light and use the tiny still images as fodder for his early masturbation sessions. He remembered most of them vividly, and certainly the discovery of his son's stash of pornography brought him back to the moment he discovered his own father's. It was strange. At first, Don lamented the fact that technology had progressed to a point that a teenage boy's first experience with pornography would never again include the discovery of his father's stash. He realized that children reaching adolescence would never again need their parents to supply them with their first glimpse at human sexuality, intentionally or otherwise. Don felt a brief moment of sadness about not being a part of that moment for his son, about not being involved in what he considered an intrinsic part of growing up. Still, he was relieved that his son's pornographic tastes contained nothing homosexual or overtly abnormal. Then he saw the clock on his son's computer, and he was reminded that he had only a precious few minutes left to masturbate before he had to get back in his car and drive back to his office, where he would spend 4 more hours trying to convince people to invest their money with or to purchase a life insurance policy from his employer, Northwestern Mutual. He had stopped years ago questioning how his life had become what it had become, but every so often, when he unbuttoned his pants, untucked his shirt, and threw his tie over his shoulder in order to masturbate with as little disrobing as possible on a lunch break from a job he despised, his mind would fire off some almost imperceptible objection. This isn't what he thought he'd be doing at 37. The first thumbnail he clicked on opened a streaming movie starring a girl he had never seen named Stoya. She was extremely attractive and extremely pale. Don had never found pale girls particularly appealing, but he knew that if he got caught in the trap of clicking on multiple videos until he found one he liked, he would most likely be late for work and would have to deal with his manager. He pulled the elastic band of his underwear down so it fit just behind his testicles and applied a small amount of pressure. Don had first implemented this technique many years ago after stumbling upon it purely by chance. He'd been lying awake the whole night as a result of his wife pressing her buttocks against his genitals as she slept. He tried gently grinding his erection against her, as this sometimes brought him to full ejaculation. But that night, Don was wearing a pair of boxers that were made of a thicker material than normal, and this just made him more incensed. He knew that the jarring motion of all-out masturbation would surely wake his wife and bring a barrage of questions that he was unwilling to endure. At some point, his wife Rachel got out of bed and went to the bathroom. Don took the opportunity to pull his underwear down under his testicles for the first time and quickly masturbate, cupping his hand to catch the ejaculated semen and wiping it on the side of the bed before Rachel came back. He didn't know if the elastic band of his underwear being placed under his testicles made his orgasm come any quicker or stronger, but he enjoyed it, and from that moment on occasionally employed the technique, especially in scenarios that required him to complete his masturbation session in a short amount of time. And so it was as Don ejaculated into a McDonald's napkin, which he crumpled up and tossed back into the bag with his empty Big Mac container and French fry sleeve. He shut his son's computer down and put it back where he found it. He was momentarily reminded once again of putting his father's pornography back in its secret location in the garage, hoping his transgression would remain undetected. As he left his house, he knew it was excessively unlikely that the series of events necessary for his wife to discover his semen-covered McDonald's napkin in their own trash can would ever transpire. But he saw no sense in taking unnecessary risk, so he threw the McDonald's bag away in the neighbor's trash can. On his drive back to work, he thought about his son and was again relieved that Chris's pornographic taste seemed normal. As he walked back into his office, Don wondered what his son was doing at school, and as much as he didn't want to, he couldn't help wondering about his son's masturbatory habits, when he did it, where or into what object he expelled his semen. He gave only a brief thought to what his wife might think of their son's indulgence in pornography. He would not tell her about his discovery. And that's it. Chapter one of this new book, Men, Women, and Children, which I think is available in this bookstore. All right. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.